Blog Talk Radio.
At the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett, and a big welcome to the callers and chatters to Research at the National Archives and Beyond. This show will provide individuals interested in genealogy and history an opportunity to listen, learn, and take action. If you have logged in as a guest, and I see a few guests in the chat room right now, and you wish to participate in the chat, you can sign in through your Facebook account or Blog Talk Radio. I will also open the lines in the second half of the show so that you can ask questions or make a comment. And then following the show, you can continue this discussion on AfroGenius.com and research at the National Archives and Beyond Facebook pages. In fact, please like both pages and join both groups. Well, tonight's discussion will focus on a book written by Andy Kumble Floyd. The title of the book is The Slaves Have Names, Ancestors of My Home. This book tells the stories of people who were enslaved on the plantation where Andy Kumble Floyd was raised in Central Virginia. It's the story of her journey to get to know these extraordinary people and to understand her debt to them, as well as our nation's continued struggles around race and the legacy of slavery. Andy Kumble Floyd is a writer, historian, and genealogist who focuses on the history and the legacy of slavery in the United States. She lives in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, where she and her husband run a small farm with goats, chickens, and big fluffy dogs. So let me give a warm welcome to Andy Kumble Floyd to research at the National Archives and Beyond. Welcome, Andy.
Well, thank you, Bernice. It's a wonderful thing to be here.
Well, it's wonderful that you could join us tonight, because we certainly look forward to hearing you share your journey. Well, before we start with your journey, why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Well, sure. Your intro kind of covered it. I'm a writer and a historian by training and practice now, and my area of interest is the history of slavery, particularly the stories of the enslaved people who were part of that horrible system, and then also trying to understand for myself and for us as a country the way the legacy of that institution plays out in our everything, our relationships, our policies, our economic system, and with the hope of maybe if we keep talking about it, finding some ways to heal the wounds that are still very real. So, and when I'm not doing that, I run this little farm, and you may hear goats in the background because they're right outside the window here. So,
oh, okay, so they're listening also. Well,
they are.
You're
they're
so
very
right. Yes, you're so right. Talking about slavery is just something that we perhaps need to do. I mean, it did exist. And my question to you, though, when did you become aware of slavery in America and that you were living on the grounds where enslaved individuals lived?
you know, I probably, like most people who were educated in the American public schools, knew sort of a little bit about slavery from probably when I was young, you know, third or fourth grade. But I only knew that in the sort of sense that slavery was bad and it ended at the end of the Civil War, and I didn't really have any real knowledge of what that meant. But when I got to college and actually had moved away from the plantation where I grew up, I took a class on actually, oddly enough, Native American cultures. And suddenly I became aware that there was this whole history of America that nobody had ever taught me before. In that case, it was about, you know, the removal of Native American tribes and the broken treaties and reservation law and all of those things. But it sparked something in me to make me realize that there were other populations of people, other elements of our national story that I didn't really know about. And at some point I started thinking about the people I had gone to high school with. Lived, you know, the county that I grew up in is very small and very rural, and still in some ways, even now, pretty segregated. I mean, people are cordial, but there's not a lot of integration in the sort of social sense. And I just started wondering if some of the people I might have ridden the school bus with had been descended from the people I knew had lived and worked and actually built this plantation I grew up on. Even though I knew very, very little about those enslaved people, I was very curious to know how their stories had turned out now. You know, what was their legacy, and was that legacy connected to people I might actually know?
Right, and it's very interesting that you thought of that as a teenager, you say, wondering whether some are older than a teenager, but wondering whether some of the individuals that went to school with you were descendants, and that's an interesting thought for a young person to want to know. So help us understand where this plantation is located and what's on the plantation.
Sure. So this plantation is in Fluvanna County, Virginia, which has one stoplight that they only got a couple years ago. So it's still very rural, right in the center of the state. So if you're familiar with Virginia, it's about 2 hours south of Washington, D.C., sort of nestled between the cities of Charlottesville, Lynchburg, and Richmond. And the plantations sit on the James River. They're still privately owned. They aren't museums. They're not open to the public. And they're still owned by the descendants of the original owner, of the man who built these plantations. They are still, as one friend of mine said when she came, they look kind of like plantation ghost towns. Most of the buildings are still standing. There are three large plantation houses there. One, the biggest of the three, was designed by the same man who designed Monticello, so it has a sort of similar look to the house that Jefferson had built. And then there are two other plantation houses. There are also still the barns that were built by the enslaved people. A lot of the work buildings, the corn cribs, the dairy, the stables. We still have two standing slave cabins, and then we have a lot of the slave quarters. We know where they were, and there are still some standing chimneys, but because most of those buildings were wood and not terribly well built at the time, most of the buildings themselves have disappeared. But there is one standing slave structure that was close to the biggest of the three plantation houses that, it's my understanding, is it's the what we call the hotel in the original documents, and that building still stands. It's a stucco structure on the outside, and yeah, and it's still there and still solid and can still walk inside it and everything.
Right. In fact, you posted two photos of the slave dwellings. Right. Can you just tell us just a little bit more about the two dwellings, especially the one that you call the hotel?
Sure. So the biggest standing structure is this one that's called the hotel. Typical in the architectural style, a 2/2. Excuse me, which means there are two rooms downstairs and two rooms upstairs. There would have been a family that lived in each of those rooms, and these would have been large families, you know, parents, at Brimo, most people were in family units, lived in family units, so a father and a mother and then several children, and they would have each all shared a room. There's a chimney in each room with a cooking area, and that's it. And then that building's interesting, and there is a picture of it on the page there. The upstairs rooms were joined by a splitting staircase. So you went up a central stair, and then the staircase kind of takes a turn at the top and goes to two sides. So that would have held anywhere, that building would have been home to anywhere between 20 and 35 or 40 people. The basement of that building, my belief is that that's where the single men who worked in the big house would have lived.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of people that lived there, and that building is very close to the big house, so it would have been probably people who worked in and around the house that lived there, so that they had quick access to whatever
right.
the owner.
And then how many acres? I mean, we're talking about this plantation. How many acres made up this plantation?
Yeah, originally it was about 6,500 acres, which for Virginia is a very large plantation. From almost the beginning, it was divided into three working farms, Upper Brimo, Lower Brimo, and Brimo Recess. They've always been owned by the same family members. They're still owned by cousins today, but they also all operate as separate units. Today, the plantation still comprises about 3,500 acres of land. So it's still a very large piece of property.
Right. It is very large. And is it profited as open to the public?
It is not.
It
is all still
okay.
privately owned. Yeah, they don't do tours and they don't open to the public. These are people's homes, and so they have caretakers and things that live there, and then the owners come and stay sometimes. But, yeah, they're all privately owned.
Wow, interesting. Well, let's just get to what's going on here. So what motivated you to start searching for the names of the slaves on the Brimo plantations?
I, growing up, knew that people had been slaves there, but, again, my concept of that was very fuzzy. And I had only ever heard two people's names mentioned. One was the name of a man named Cato. And Cato was a mason, a stonemason. And that is really all I knew about him. And then the other was a man named Primus. And I didn't really know very much about Primus, except that his gravestone is in the slave cemetery at Brimo still. And it's marked. His name is on it. And those were really the only two names I knew. But I knew that these people had to have names. Obviously, human beings, we name each other, so they had names. And I was really eager to find descendants. That's kind of what I started out looking for, you know, what my goal was to find these people. And so to do that, I needed to find names. But
yeah.
Anybody who research in slavery knows finding the surnames of enslaved people is very hard for a lot of reasons. You know, it's very difficult to find. They didn't have legal surnames, so they're not in records. They also may have been called by the name of their plantation owner, whether they took that name themselves or not. That sometimes was how they were named. And sometimes, as it was the case at Brimo, they had family names that they had chosen for themselves or had carried maybe from other places where they had lived or been at some point. And I didn't have any records that showed that. So I went to a book called Dear Master, which was edited by a man named Randall Miller. And it is a collection. It's a wonderful book, a collection of the letters that some of the enslaved people at Brimo had written back to their master after they had moved on to other places. So the master at Brimo, General John Hartwell Cock, had his slaves were educated. They were taught to read and write. They were actually given, for the time, a fairly comprehensive education for as long as they could do that and still manage their workload. So they weren't super educated, but they were literate, and that's you know, that was rare for anybody in that time period, but particularly for enslaved people. And this collection of letters is a rare thing to have enslaved people writing to their master. And so these people were writing from the new plantations that General Cox had built in Alabama back to Virginia, where he is living. And then he actually freed a few of his slaves to go to Liberia. And so some of these letters are written from these formerly enslaved people who are now living on the continent of Africa and writing back. And in those letters, Randall Miller uses surnames for these families. And I read the book and immediately got in touch with him, and he was like, you know, I'd have to dig through my papers. I don't really know how I know that, but I'm confident that my names are right. And so I kind of just had to trust that that was true, and so I started with the names that he had found. And I went then back into the document at the University of Virginia in their Special Collections Library. There are 195 boxes of primary source documents from these plantations. And I went folder by folder looking for any mention of an enslaved person. And
now,
I found a few. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay, go ahead, because I'm getting questions from the chat room, and you jumped to the 195 boxes at UVA. Now,
yes,
were these boxes actually identified as the Brimo Plantation records, or what were they called?
They're called the Cox Family Papers. So it's C-O-C-K-E.
C-O-C-K-E.
Mm-hmm.
The Cox Family Papers. Okay.
Cox Family Papers. And if you're at UVA, it's manuscript number 640. And they're open to the public, the papers. The family has donated the papers, so they're available to researchers. So if people have kinship ties, they think, to this part of Virginia, it's a good place to go, because the general was very well connected with other wealthy families in Virginia at the time. So there's a lot of correspondence there.
Right. Now, let me just kind of talk back and forth with you and with the chatters also. You mentioned Alabama, and there's a question, where in Alabama?
It was originally, I always get these backwards, it was originally Hale County, but has since split into Hale and Greene County.
Okay.
Plantations were in what is now Greene County, G-R-E-E-N-E,
mm-hmm.
which is south of Birmingham. And the two plantations were called Hopewell and New. And I was not able to find a lot of information about life there itself. I just may not have found the right place. But at the University of Alabama Archives, they have a Cox Family Papers collection. I'm not sure it's called exactly that, but they have a Cox collection as well. And in that collection, there is a list of the people who walked from Virginia to Alabama to work and live at these new plantations.
Wow. That is amazing. And it's just wonderful to hear that the manuscript 640 was there for you to start reviewing the various names. Now, let's go back, because you mentioned a cemetery. And you mentioned Cato and you mentioned Primus. So tell me about your journey in the cemetery, who's in the cemetery, and then what were you able to find out about those that were in the grave?
Sure. The cemetery is it's preserved. It's completely preserved. It's been it's always had a wall around it, and so it's fairly clear. We know where the boundaries are and those kinds of things. In there, we estimate approximately 100 people buried. Most of those people, as is usually the case with slave cemeteries, don't have stones, don't have marked stones in particular, but most of them don't have any kind of stone. They might have had a wooden marker to begin with, but it's long since deteriorated.
Okay.
In the cemetery, there are three marked stones. So there's Primus, who was a foreman at Upper Brimo, which meant he was he oversaw the tasks and made sure everybody went to the right task for the day. There is Jesse Nicholas. Nicholas Skipwith. It's a little unclear from the records which surname he went by, but he was the hostler and the cobbler on the farm. So he worked with animals and made shoes and things. And my assumption is that his stone is very, it looks very much like a traditional gravestone. It's rounded at the top, and the writing on it is very ornate. It's curlicued almost. And my assumption is that his son, who is also a Jesse Nicholas, was a mason. And so my assumption is that his son probably made his stone for him. And then the third stone is a very large gravestone, and it's for a man named Ben Creasy. And Ben was the carpenter. And Ben, he did all the woodworking that I so appreciate on these big plantation houses. He was just very talented. And Ben's family, it turns out his descendants were people I actually went to high school with. And his family and I have become good friends. And they've come back to the cemetery to help us restore it. The men of that family have come, and we've relaid some of the corners of the cemetery, and they've brought generations. And it's been a wonderful experience to have them come and be in that place. And I feel honored to have been able to play a tiny part in getting them there. So.
Right. So at what point did you connect with the descendant of Ben Creasy?
Well, I am part of a group of people called the Central Virginia History Researchers, and they are all, and their website is centralvirginiahistory.org, which is important because our whole mission is to help people find their ancestors in Virginia, particularly Albemarle County and Charlottesville, that were held in slavery, who are professional historians and independent historians, and they have a wealth of resources. And at that website, centralvirginiahistory.org, you can find a database that is just a preliminary run, but you can search it in ways you can't search Ancestry or the other big genealogy sites. You can search by first name and pull up, and you can search by owner. And so you can find, you know, you might know you had an ancestor named Moses, and he was owned by a certain family. You can search by that. So when I started trying to do this research through the way that, you know, everybody knows the world, this genealogy world's pretty small and connected. So somebody recommended I contact this group, and in that group, a man named Bob Vernon had done research on the Creasy family, and he actually put me in touch with Joe Creasy, who is Ben Creasy's 4 times great-grandson. And so we just connected from there, and I've since connected with several other descendants of people who built my home, and it's been a really wonderful experience to get to know them.
Yes, I can imagine that has been a wonderful experience. Now, there's a question coming out of the chat. Does this Cox family line connect with the Cable family of Nelson County, Virginia?
They do, actually. So General Cox's daughter married Nicholas Falcone Cable. So there's a direct connection there. And the Cable family and the Cox family still to this day are good friends. So there's a very long-standing connection. In terms of the enslaved communities at Brimo and then the Cable Plantation, I've done only some preliminary research there, but there's a very good chance that there's a connection there. Derek Nicholas, who some of your listeners may know well, has done a great deal of research into the Cable family plantations, and he's an amazing resource for finding people connected to those families.
Right, and it was actually Derek who raised the question.
Oh, there it is. There it is. Well,
yes.
Good. Hi, Derek. But, yeah, he's done some research, and Derek and I have talked. We're talking about Cables and Cox in Virginia at this time. We're talking about the wealthiest families in Virginia and very elite. So they would have been socializing only with one another, which means they probably would have had slaves that, at the very least, knew one another, perhaps intermarried, perhaps there were sales between the families. So there's a very good chance that if you have a connection to one of the wealthiest families in Virginia during this time, you may have connections to many of the others as well.
Yes. Well, we're going to take a break, come back, because I want you to now get into the slaves, their names, and what you found out about them, because you just mentioned one was a carpenter, and I want to know more about the slaves and the other stories that you were able to tell or to imagine as you pulled together your book. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. At the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett, and you can join me every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, where I will have an expert to share resources, stories, and answer your burning genealogy questions. Remember, all of my guests share a deep passion and knowledge of genealogy and history. All of my shows are available as a podcast immediately after the broadcast and can be downloaded from Blog Talk Radio and iTunes. Now, you have been listening to Andy Combo Floyd share her experience of growing up on the Brimo Plantation and her journey to discover the names of the slaves on that plantation. So let's go back to Andy so that she could share more with us. Now, Andy, you told us about the resources, but tell us about the people. What kind of work did they do, and who were they? Give us some of your main family groups that you were able to discover.
Sure. So, I mean, there were 200, we approximate 246 people enslaved, and so I have done as much research as I can for this book to find out about them because it's their stories that actually matter to me. So, but as anybody knows that has done this research, there's only so much you can gather from an inventory or a mention in a letter. And so I did my book is a combination of the history and then my imagining of what it would mean to,
yes,
to live that particular life there. So one of my favorite people I found is a woman named Lucy Nicholas. She was the nurse for the master's children. So she would have literally been their nursemaid. She would have nursed them when they were infants, but she also would have sort of been their nanny, I guess is the word we would use now, for when they were, as they got older. And I think she was probably an incredible woman. She was married to Jesse Nicholas, the man I mentioned before, who was the cobbler. And they had a number of children, who seem to have all been skilled, very educated, very capable people. But Lucy's story is very interesting because she was so important to her owner's family that she's actually the only enslaved person that is buried in the family cemetery at Brimo. And her story is just so powerful because her one of the children she raised, Sally, the master's daughter, actually encouraged, my understanding is, encouraged her father to come home from the east coast of Virginia when Lucy died so that they could be there for her funeral, which I think it is just powerful statement, because to drive or to travel from the eastern part of the state to the middle part of the state would have been a couple days' ride. So they did that, and they were there, and she's buried in the cemetery. She's unfortunately not buried with a marked stone. The only reason I know she's buried there is that there is an old plat of the family cemetery, and it's marked Lucy Nurse.
Okay. And when, now there are a couple of questions coming out of the chat. So let's go to Jesse. What year was Jesse, at least what year did she marry Jesse? Did you find any kind of details about that family relationship? And what year was Jesse born?
Oh, that's a good question. I always get all the dates messed up in my head. I'll look that up as I talk. I don't know when they married. Because at the time, they wouldn't have been legally allowed to marry. They probably jumped the broom or had a similar ceremony. The owner definitely encouraged the enslaved people on his plantations to marry. He saw it as a stabilizing force, I guess. But I don't know any details about their relationship beyond what I can imagine. I'm still looking for Jesse's birthday while I sit here.
Okay. Well, while you're looking for the birthday, I do have another question for you, because while you identified Lucy as the nurse, what other work did some of the other slaves perform on the plantation? In addition to what Lucy did, or the carpenter, and the masons, what else did they do?
Sure. So they would have had hostlers, which would have been the horse wranglers. The master raised thoroughbred, and so the hostler raised thoroughbreds. By the way, Jesse was born in 1775 and died in 1838.
Okay.
They would have also, they would have had field hands. They raised a lot of crops, wheat. They did a little cotton. They did tobacco for a time. So people would have worked in the fields, as they did on most plantations. We had Lucy Skipwith was the school teacher. She actually ran the slave school in Virginia. And then when they moved to Alabama, she actually ran the slave school at the Alabama plantation as well. There were gardeners. There was a very large vegetable garden at Upper Brimo. There were foremen. The general used enslaved people sometimes as his overseers, so occasionally they had roles as overseers. And then there would have been Betsy, Primus's wife, was a shepherdess, so she would have taken care of the sheep. So they did all the things that you would think of as farm life, they did as part of their obligation, I guess is the least harsh word for to the master. So all kinds of things. They did all kinds of things.
Right. So it was it what you would call one of those plantations where everything centered around the work that the slaves did on that plantation to keep it functioning, and they really didn't, they were self-sustaining, or did they have to go out to bring goods and other things into the plantation?
It was not completely self-sustaining. I mean, it's certainly in terms of food. The slaves raised and harvested all the food. But in terms of fabric, other kinds of materials, even building materials, sometimes they went actually out. And that's one of the things that's at EVA Special Collections is the merchant records. And that's one of the ways I found out about who some of the people were. There'll be mentions of a man named Phil, for example, who was a postillion, which is not a term we hear now, but he would have ridden the carriage when the general went out in his formal carriage to help with luggage, to help in and out. And in the records, there's some mentions of him taking payments or making payments for his master. So he was fairly well-traveled. He would have been places. The other thing that the general did to cover, I guess, his expenses for these things he was buying was he hired his slaves out to lots of places, so to other plantation owners, but also to professors at the University of Virginia. They would go and work for other people, and then the general would be paid for their labor. So they never made money from that. But I try to when I try to be positive, I try to think, well, they saw more of the world than many of the people at Brimo saw. So maybe that was hopeful. I don't know.
Yes, but the fact is they were still enslaved.
Yes, ma'am.
Still enslaved. So, you know, this when you talk about this plantation, there's so many things, and I'm just going to take it from an African-American perspective. When you're trying to do research, you hit a brick wall somewhere. And so tell us, as you began to search, what kinds of brick walls did you hit?
That's an excellent question. Because I started from before emancipation, so pre-1865, I hit what I think of as the front side of the 1865 wall. And many of the genealogists I know who work on African-American lineages hit it from the back side. You know, they're coming from their time now. And then when they get to 1865, the trail kind of goes cold, or 1870 for that census. So that's where I ended up with some trouble sometimes. I could get to emancipation, and then wonderfully, these people could then choose their own surnames, they could choose where they lived. I couldn't necessarily climb over that wall and find where those lineages went now. In a few cases, I was able to, but there are still family lines that I haven't been able to track. So
right.
That was one challenge. And then surnames are very difficult because of that. You know, people didn't have legal surnames. And then the names that they chose after emancipation may have been names they carried before emancipation, but they may not have been. Maybe they just wanted a completely fresh start, and they took a new name. And so that's another challenge of that. And then just the sheer lack of information. I mean, these people were horribly treated as property, so there's nothing personal written down about them. I mean, I think I have one physical description of someone, and it's not a flattering one. You know, there's nothing, nobody, I don't know what anybody looked like. We have no pictures of any of these individuals. And so a lot of this, I just don't know enough to be able to get a really good look at who these people were as individuals, and that's hard.
Right. And then there's a question coming out of chat. It's about Cock. And the question is, didn't he write a pamphlet entitled Standing Rules for the Government of Slaves on a Virginia Plantation?
He did. Yes, he did. He was pretty famous for that. And that document is comparatively for the time more progressive than many slave owners would have thought permissible. And he actually got, you know, the general was almost beaten to death in the local town for educating his slaves.
Mm-hmm.
So he was doing some things that were controversial. He still didn't free his enslaved people. He actually didn't believe that it was a good idea to free enslaved people for lots of reasons that are probably far more complex than we can hash out tonight. But he did believe in good care. He did believe in educating people. He did believe in providing them training so that if they ever did achieve freedom, they had a skill, a marketable skill. And that is why so many of these people were masons or carpenters and things. But he did write that pamphlet. And, you can probably – I haven't even tried, but you could probably just Google it and read it online.
Right. Well, Salma Stewart mentioned it. Thank you, Salma. That's a resource that we can all take a look at to see what were those standing rules
mm-hmm.
for the government of slaves on a Virginia plantation. No doubt that the states and other individuals looked at those rules and adapted them to meet their needs in various communities. Now, I want to go back. You talked about, you know, the difficulty moving forward, you know, beyond emancipation, yet you mentioned going to school with some of the descendants of the people that were enslaved on this plantation. Have you had an opportunity, other than to meet the Creasy descendant, any other descendants, or to share with them some of the stories that you're telling or you're imagining based upon what you have uncovered about the slaves on the plantation?
I actually have. Lucy Skipwith, let me get the number of greats right, has 5 times great-granddaughter and I are friends, and her name is Carol, and she lives in Ohio now, and actually her parents were the first people to were part of the integration movement in Cleveland, which I think is just a wonderful story. So I've had an opportunity to talk with her. I haven't met her yet, but I'm going to Ohio in September, and I'm going to get to meet Carol and hopefully her daughter as well. And that's been really wonderful. Locally, once this book came out, I suddenly realized there were a whole bunch of people that I knew or I knew, you know, in passing from school that were descended from these individuals. And so I've had the opportunity to have lots of conversations with them. Someone recently just contacted me because he's descended from Champion, another person I talk about in the book. And
yes.
That's been really very exciting. And, you know, we're trying to work together. It's really nice because she's done her genealogy back to a certain point, and I can come forward to a certain point. And hopefully we're going to find that meeting point and be able to give her, you know, some more cousins. And it's really fun. Like, I think that's the most wonderful part of all this, is just seeing people find part of their stories that maybe they didn't know. And I'm just happened to have a little bit of information to share, and it makes me feel very honored. So I have found a lot of people actually found me, which has been really wonderful.
Which is great, which makes you a resource to
yes.
them to share some of the information that you have uncovered. Well, I know that you made a remarkable discovery about your own ancestral links. And I'd like you to share with the listeners what that discovery was.
Well, yeah, when I started this book, I kind of had this just framework of trying to do a parallel storyline of the people who were enslaved at Bremo and then my father's family, who were white tobacco sharecroppers in North Carolina. So impoverished people, but two very distinctive, different historical experiences. I didn't go anywhere with that because the people at Bremo were just so amazing, and I wanted to stay with that story. But I did do enough work to dig into my own genealogy and discover that my 3 times great-grandfather was actually a free man of color, and that he had, at the age of 7, moved away from his family to pass as white. And my Kumbo line identifies as white, but most of the other Kumbos in Virginia and North Carolina are African American. And so it's been a really wonderful discovery to meet all these cousins who I never knew I had because of the legacy of slavery and racism in our country. My grandfather, who has passed, rest his soul, would not have been able to accept. He actually didn't ever go far enough to find out. I suspect because he might have known that they were free people of color, and he didn't really want to know that. I love it. I think it's amazing. And we're actually all descended, all the Kumbos in the United States are descended from a single man who came over into the Jamestown area of Virginia in about the 1630s and 40s on a Portuguese slave ship, and his name was Emmanuel Cambo. And he was actually freed and given 50 acres of land in 1651. So he was a free person of color very, very early in the history of our country. And I think that's just great. It's so good. And that's actually where my research is now. That's what I'm working on now.
Yes. Well, you know, what you're saying to us right now kind of ties in with a show I had 2 weeks ago called The Invisible Line. And if you had an opportunity to listen to that show, then you heard of people actually crossing the color line, going from black to white, and basically not looking back. And so with you saying about your grandfather, you know, there's comments coming out that perhaps he did know of his family lineage, and this was just something that he chose not to share. But with you, you're mentioning you have all of these cousins. Have you and the cousins gotten together?
Not yet. Well, one and I have, because it turns out that one of my cousins from another line of Kumbos, although their name is Kumbi now, she's also white. She lives in it. We didn't know each other. She lives 10 miles from me by sheer coincidence. So she and I have become good friends. But we are planning, she and I are hoping to plan a reunion for all the Kumbos down here in Virginia so we can all get to meet. We talk a lot on Facebook, but we haven't gotten to get together, but we hope to soon.
Yes, and that probably will be a very interesting and heartwarming moment when all of you have an opportunity to get together. Well, I want you to just share with us some feelings right now, because you have gone on this journey. You have actually documented the fact that 240-plus slaves were on this plantation, and you have the names. What does that mean to you to have done this?
I think I feel very honored to have had the privileges I have to be able to do that, to have grown up in this place, which is a beautiful place, to be able to have the education and the financial resources to be able to do the research and dedicate the time that it took to do this. I think I just mostly feel honored. And I'm heartbroken in many ways. I don't think I wrote any of the chapters of this book without crying, just from the sheer horror of what life must have been like for these people, but also just from the sheer lack of story for them. You know, there's only so much to know. And I keep hoping that I'm going to find descendants who have this wonderful written and oral tradition, and I'll hear more stories, and I'll know these stories have lived, but I haven't had that yet. So I think those are the, and then I just feel a deep commitment to finding a way to heal the wounds of this, because the other piece of my family history, of course, is that part of my ancestry, they were slave owners, and so you know, I don't carry a great amount of guilt for that, but I do feel responsible. I mean, we have a legacy, we have a history of a nation that is built on this institution. And I feel very powerfully that we've got to find a way to look at this history and heal. So,
yes, and not only that, but we have to look at a way to tell those stories. We have to look at a way that the descendants can tell their stories. You have a question, though, and this is from area code 270. You're live, area code 270.
Hi, Bernice. Hi, Andy. It's
Hello.
Me, True, from My True Roots.
Hi, True.
Hi. Hi. It's more of a comment. I just wanted to let you know that I have read the book, and I still reference back to it. And it just struck me all the tenderness that you showed by telling their stories, and I really appreciated that. That's what struck me the most about the book, about, you know, how you started after your mother passed. And I just appreciate the book, and I hope that it gives hope to other families like yours that can, you know, the book can be passed around to show how you can do this effectively for other families of slaves. So I just wanted to make that comment, and thank you, and I've been enjoying the show and been enjoying all your little things that you have online about your farm and everything. So I just wanted to let you know I appreciated that.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you for calling in, True. Well, I would like you to just take an excerpt. Take one of your chapters. It's called Me Now. And read it. Let everyone hear kind of your voice and what it means, me now.
Sure. I've become one of those obnoxious people who can't just let it go. When I walk around this place now, I don't really see what everyone else sees. Beautiful homes, gorgeous landscapes, a pristine farm set off from the world. What I see is bricks handmade and carried up ladders onto scaffolding in buckets or hauled on platforms using thick ropes and the ropey, muscled arms of hardworking men. I barely see massive stone pillars set into the ground as gateposts. I see men whose backs are nearly broken with the weight of setting that stone in place. I don't see a spinning wheel as a reminder of practices forgotten but pure. I see women set in front of those wheels, spinning as fast as they can so that they can make enough thread to clothe not only their master's family but their own too. I just don't see this place the same way I did when I was that teenage girl throwing a Halloween party in the slave graveyard. I am both saddened and proud of this fact. Some days, though, when the sun is angled low across the trees and the shadows are long enough to look like drapes, when the wind is quiet enough to make it feel like the trees are whispering, I see it again, the absolute and profound gorgeousness that is this place. Then I cry. I started out writing this book to provide a voice to the voiceless, to be the voice speaking for enslaved people, to be a reminder of what we have often intentionally forgotten in our history. Part of me still hopes that this book will be that, but I have also realized how arrogant I was to think I could speak for anyone else, to think that I could give voice to an experience that was not mine, to imagine these people did not have voices. I do not know how Lucy Nicholas felt as she nursed the general's children. I do not know how Richard felt as he was sold off of this place so permanently. I do not know how Bill felt when he arrived here to see his family's cemetery. These are not my experiences. My experiences of a white woman who has realized her own naivete and ignorance. Writing this book has taught me so much about what I do not know. Even with more than 18 months of research poured into these pages, I still have hundreds of boxes of documents at UVA alone to consider. I still have hundreds of people to study. I still have books and books about slavery and its legacy to read. I have so much left to learn, and even if I read and study it all, I still will have more to know. Yet, this writing has changed me. Here, above all else, is what I have learned. I have learned that America's decision to use skin color as the method for determining who is free and who is not has wounded us so deeply that as a country and as individuals, we have to take radical steps to heal this wound. Somewhere along the way, and it will take much more study by me and many others to try and find out where, slavery became not about economics, as horrible as that is, but about power. About one group of people deciding that they could and should control the fate of another group of people. Slavery became about race, about black people's perceived inability to care for themselves or participate fully in American society. It was this belief that drove the general's ideas of colonization. It was this idea that, along with economic self-interest and selfishness, drove the southern states to secede. It was this idea that led to civil war, to massive bloodshed, to a rift in our country that still exists, even as we consider it charming and sentimental. It was this belief that led to the development of Jim Crow, and this belief that drove segregation and the KKK and church bombings and lynching. It is this belief that we see in our prison systems today and in the achievement gap in our schools. This belief that shows through in our earnings charts and our census data. This belief that keeps black people ghettoized in our inner cities and ostracized in our suburbs. This belief that here in my town in 2013 has black people sitting on one side of the room and white people on the other at a public dance. If this book has changed one thing about me, it's this. I see this wound, and I am determined to do what I can to heal it. For me, this has meant ripping back the covering of history and race that we lay over our prejudices. It has meant staring hard at the way I have been taught, have absorbed, and even thought my way to racist beliefs. It has meant admitting these beliefs and learning how to change them. For me, this learning has meant I have to do some hard, hard looking at myself so that I can see where I need to change. For too long, I have remained objective about slavery, laying it back on the shelves of history like some fine linen that I study but never want to tease apart for its stains. I am no longer content to simply study history. I must look for a way to heal its legacy. Getting to know Primus and Malvina and Gruff and Cassia and Jesse has taught me that slavery was not just an institution, not just the way things were done. It was about people, people whose choice to live as they wished was taken away in the most violent and systematic way. Getting to know Berthier and Leander and Minerva and Lucy has taught me that today our issues around race are not just about people. They are systematic and deeply ingrained in how we think of ourselves as Americans. I have learned my most valuable lesson, that our American dream of getting ahead through our rugged individualism doesn't work at all when we take away the ability for someone to travel as they please, marry who they wish, and call themselves by name, when we deprive them of the ability to learn and to earn and to speak. I have learned that America has some dark, shadowy fears in our dreams, ones that haunt me even in my waking. I have learned that I am part of the system, and I am determined to change me. One word, one box of records, one conversation, one story at a time.
Beautiful. You've said it. You've said it. And there's a comment coming out of the chat. Every time, and this is coming from True, every time when someone asks about what to do when they find slaves in the family, she tries to reference them to your book.
Oh, what a wonderful thing. Well, thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Do you have any parting words before we close out tonight?
The only thing I would say is if you think you have family that might be kin to people at Brimo, I would love to hear from you. You can contact me very easily through my website, and I'm happy to share the records and the information that I have. It's not something I own. I believe very strongly this is something everybody needs to have, and so I'm happy to share everything I know.
Well, thank you so very much, and I certainly hope that others are inspired by you to put it in writing, to share it, to reach out to those descendants, because the descendants are looking also.
Mm-hmm.
They want to know. And if their descendants of those from Primrose Plantation, I would hope that they would reach out to you so that you can come together and share the information that you have gathered. So thank you so much, Andy. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay. Well, everyone, please tune in next week for a discussion with Professor Dorothy Roberts. The title of her discussion and her book is Fatal Inventions, How Science, Politics, and Big Business Recreate Race into 21st Century. This should be quite an interesting show, simply because so many of us are now taking DNA tests. And so she's going to talk about the entire science and just where is it taking us. So I'd just like to just say to everyone, just good night. Thank you, Andy Combo Floyd. And remember, everyone, your ancestors left footprints. Therefore, you should follow the clues that are presented to you through oral history, family records, and research at the National Archives and beyond. Now, you can continue this discussion on the Research at the National Archives and Beyond and Afrogenia's Facebook pages. And also remember to listen to the African Roots podcast with Angela Walton Raji on Friday morning. And I hope everyone had an opportunity to listen to Angela Walton Raji on yesterday when freedom comes. Also remember to listen to Nurturing Our Roots with Antoinette Harrell. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett, and I look forward to you joining me next Thursday. Good night, everyone.